cloudy on the top.
Hi everyone, this is episode 3 of Backjack, the Samurai Jack Rewatch Podcast. I'm Matt, and this is...
Andy, how you guys doing?
And today we'll be discussing the premiere episode of Samurai Jack, In the Beginning.
That's episode number 1, and as we mentioned before, Samurai Jack actually got a full season order, as I understand it. So they were able to do all of this and call it the first... episode here. So what we're going into on this one, I believe, is Aku's rebirth. Last time we looked at where Aku came from and how Jack's dad banished him. And this time around, Matt has a brief synopsis for us to kind of kick us off for the episode.
In the beginning, Aku returns, bringing with him familiar destruction. The Emperor is forced to make a difficult decision, and his plan is set in motion. But will it be enough?
Yeah, actually, I think it will be. I mean, at this point, season 5 isn't done. Oh, it was rhetorical. Okay.
Oh, no. Well, hey, you know what? The jury's still out on that, too.
Yeah, I have, for the record, at this point in time right now when we're recording, I have not actually seen season 5 yet. I'm waiting, as I tend to do, for the whole thing to get done, and then I'll watch all of it. But I have not seen season 5 yet, so I'm kind of going in halfway naked on just the first episodes, but I'll be caught up probably by the next time we do this.
So, I, on the other hand, am still perfectly clothed, and I'm afraid I have seen season 5, being impatient as I am. But I've quite enjoyed it, and I'll try to keep that from really... I don't want to spoil it before anybody else has seen it, so...
True.
We'll try to keep that to a bare minimum. Nothing spoilery.
True. Even when I watch it, I'll try not to reference anything that directly happens in it. I have my own theories about how Jack goes about doing things, about the people he meets, about the nature of evil in the world. But a lot of this will depend as we watch to see whether my headcanon actually fits. So as we are starting out and opening this episode, it's a beautiful, desolate landscape. And we saw this last time, too, when we saw what Aku does to the land around him,
yep.
Which is just nothing. And there's this one evil, twisted tree.
It does look a lot like some kind of stump. But what we do sort of see from it is he's definitely more contained than he was as a tar pit. There's mm-hmm. no big spike forest around him. He's really quite... he's in remission as far as an infection on the world. He's really... he's not a problem now. But then we see, like many things in the world, is not permanent.
If you look closely in the background, you can see the shaded ruins of what was left behind, of what destroyed last time. Because so it's very clear that the Emperor did not wish to occupy anywhere near there.
Yeah.
But he still knows where Aku is because he planted him. He knows exactly where to keep an eye on the bad guy. But it's kind of a nice touch. You know, it's a nice future callback from the episode they did 2 seasons later, but the continuity is still there, which is just brilliant writing for me.
Yeah, you know, you could tell they planned on having it look like, you know, there were ruins nearby because the Emperor fought him back then when they made this episode, which was, I guess, 3 years before the birth of evil that we just watched was. Mm-hmm. But actually, it looks like when they made the birth of evil, they asked themselves, well, we want to tell a story that still makes sense with the content we made for episode 1. So clearly he got planted somewhere very close to buildings, you know? And what did we see in the birth of evil? We see he's been planted pretty close to
buildings. The ruins. Yep. That's where the Emperor was fighting him. In the ruins of the city that Aku had been destroying for however long the poor dude was hanging on the tree. So he basically is like biding his time that whole time in the middle of a big blasted field with the bright sun overhead repressing him. And, you know, obviously the sword did something to him. The sword drained every last ounce of evil that he had absorbed from eating or killing anything. So Aku is stuck. He has very few, life forms to feel suffering from in that desolate area. So he's stuck until the camera pans up and we start seeing
some kind of eclipse forms in the sky.
But not just any kind of eclipse. It's not just a partial, because partial eclipses are far more common. A partial eclipse happen every couple of years. But a full eclipse that comes over that specific part of the world, I think in my life there's only been like 5, and I'm 43.
Yeah.
So they don't come real, real often. And the way that this particular thing happened was the sun was blocked out for just long enough. You know, Ra's power coming from that sun was rebuked for just a few seconds even as the show shows it.
Yeah.
Which was enough for Aku to say, fuck this shit, I'm out of here!
No, yeah, it's worth pointing out that the sun being blocked is what allowed Aku to be born again.
Yeah, and it was if taken on its own, this is why we wanted to do Birth of Evil first, because taken on its own, it's a little lame. It's like, yeah. Oh, there's an evil tree, there's a lunar eclipse, it pops out of the ground. Oh, okay, who's this guy? What? Okay, we saw him in the ads, that's Aku, that's the bad guy, now what? So yeah. It's all very sudden at the beginning, if you don't have Birth of Evil as a backstory for it.
Yep.
We think that made it cooler, that's why we did it first. But Aku immediately wakes up and says, okay, I'm back in business.
Well, he doesn't really say that. He actually says,
once again, I am free to smite the world as I did in days long past.
Pretty good Aku impression, actually. That's not bad.
I thought it was pretty great. And I think it's also worth noting, we'll talk about this again later, when he turned around, he looked a lot like a totem pole. When he turns, he's perfectly cylindrical head, you know?
and he comes into profile for a minute and he has this beak nose, which we always see from the front. But that's exactly how Japanese demon masks looked.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Like, masks. I looked it up online. The pictures look exactly like that.
Yeah.
They did a great job with the art on Aku. And when he turns around, like, that's the only expressive part of him. That is there, like his eyes and his mouth. Those are like the two big things about him that move.
Yep.
Very distinctly when he talks. It's clear that they spent some animation budget on making Aku's lips and expression like as exact as possible. And everything else was left fairly abstract. Even his body is just like 5 or 6 lines.
Yeah, and you can tell like the more we see him through the episode, most of the times that he's depicted, at least here in episode 1, we can see he's being depicted, and even in The Birth of Evil a lot of times, he's almost being depicted as an impression of what Aku's really doing.
Mm-hmm.
They show him from all these dramatic angles and such, and we can sort of get a feeling like, this isn't exactly what's really going on, but this is the feeling you would have if you were
holding it.
If you were these archers, you'd feel like this. You know, you'd feel like he's a million miles up in the air when his actual height varies from scene to scene. But, so we see him sort of, set off, and then it skips over to a retelling of what we saw in The Birth of Evil.
And it's very impressionistic. Like it's definitely, it almost looks, I think the action's on the wall, isn't it? Like,
oh yes, it's clearly it's a ukiyo-e painting that's been made on the wall. In the exact style. I really loved it. And they even mention those 3 monks and show them, like, sitting on a cloud, you know?
Yeah, they looked back on it and did a very good job of it. Not just that, but it was like, okay, here's the myth. Here's the myth that was told by the Emperor in strong, broad, emotional, almost simplistic terms to make sure people remembered it.
Right.
Like, we need strong story beats so people know who Aku is, what kind of a hero it took to beat him, and how dangerous he is. Like, the Emperor had told this story, and the people who lived past it, the few who were able to escape, often remembered it this way.
Well,
so
yeah,
he commissioned artists by telling this grand heroic tale.
Right. A cautionary tale needs to, it may need to be true, but almost more importantly, it needs to leave a strong impression on the listener.
Yes.
Such that they could retell it. That's the point of a cautionary tale, is to have it retold over the generations.
And it already, even only a few years later, had aspects of a legendary fairy tale. Like the way that, even the way that the Emperor was portraying it felt like a legendary fairy tale. But really, I mean, when we look at Jack, he's what, like seven?
Yeah.
He's a kid.
It's highly possible that the Emperor didn't expect to see this guy again in his own lifetime. He must have thought he sealed him away for a good amount of time. Because he was making this, he made the story, like I said, expecting it to need to be retold. He's painting it on the wall. I mean,
for future emperors and things to see.
You don't paint that on the wall of your palace if you think your palace is about to get set on fire again. So,
I don't know. Some movie stars, you know, keep movie posters of the movies they were in their giant Hollywood mansions.
They probably don't expect the Shogun of Sorrow to show up and burn it down, though. You know,
God, do you know how much those, you know how much those posters would go for in auction? I mean, seriously, like 10,000-15,000 bucks. I mean, they could sell off a few of those and get cocaine for the party they were going to throw. It's just like, that's what you do. But, we have this wonderful tale told by him, and he, and again, as I'm pointing out, like the Emperor is old. He was middle-aged when this happened. He says he was a young Emperor when it happened. He was only young by comparison. Being in your late 30s or early 40s feels young to someone who is much older. And the Emperor was not that young when he had Jack.
Yeah.
It was very clear that when we saw him in Birth of Evil, he was mid-40s. He was a powerful hero in his prime, as we mentioned. But this Emperor, he was going bald. He still had the top knot, still had his grace and bearing. He was done being a hero. This is what he wanted to be in the first place.
Yeah.
A good, administrative, retired hero. And instead, and Jack is inspired by this, though, because he starts slinging his sword around like.
Well, I mean, he finishes the story, and you can tell Jack is enamored. Again, the Emperor cautions him, like, hey, you know, this isn't supposed to be a cool story. This isn't something, hey, I may be wrong. This may be about to happen, because he even says to Jack, you know, what was it?
Always be alert, my son. For the presence of evil is sometimes right behind you.
So, in a way, for him especially, that's to say, this isn't so far behind me as I'm telling it. Sound. Yeah.
Yeah. That's nice. Yeah. That's kind of a callback about, yeah, I know I told it mythical. It really just happened.
Yeah. Like you're only a few years old and you were born at the end of that story.
He didn't mention that, though.
Yep.
Notice that? He never mentioned to Jack at all, and that's when you were born, and your mother and I got you out. He didn't personalize the story.
Well, yeah, because
it was about him, and he told it like a myth.
If you tell somebody they were born on the same day as an unspeakable evil, that's going to have some effects.
Yeah, that's gonna create some therapy problems.
Maybe that has something to do with the way Jack is more of an Antiochu than his father. His father was an emperor. He had other things in his life.
True. Yeah, his character sheet had more powers and skills on it. Like we were showing, he probably had some internecine conflict. He was obviously a good warrior against men. He was obviously a really good leader of men. But Jack, in how he is trained, of men of his culture, I'll put it that way. The emperor was very good at leading and being part of men of his culture. And when he got them all to fight together, they fought for a surprisingly long time against Aku before they got eaten. So when he hits this point at the end of it, he probably makes a decision that Jack isn't going to have that debilitation, that Jack is not going to be so narrow because his skills weren't up to the task. He needed the gods' help to fight them. And then his skills were barely up to the task. But the whole idea, speaking as a dad, you want your kid to be better than you.
Yeah.
That's the point. You want your kid to exceed you at a certain point. And you want to sit there and just wave a big foam finger and say, go, kid, go.
Mm-hmm.
And he was setting Jack up for that. I have a feeling as this progresses, Jack is swinging the sword around because it's obviously play forms. You know, he's watched the guard train.
Yeah.
And he's doing this. And then Aku attacks out of nowhere immediately. Boom. And we see this happen in other movies too, where everything's going along fine, and then the big bad thing happens.
Yeah.
You know, we start the story as close to the end as we can. Aku attacks immediately and starts laying waste to everything. And Aku remembers how this is done.
Oh, yes.
Bah, actually, flame.
It's funny, you know, just even Aku's appearance in that scene when he comes up to the palace, it's clearly not literally what he looked like coming up to the palace.
Mm-hmm.
It's this weird shadow that's being cast over the palace.
Oh, and the quality of the light yep. changes to red.
So you can see like that. It's almost like this is what Jack remembers when he was a kid. This evil thing just loomed over the palace, like room, the door he was in front of.
Yeah. And he was even like small compared to his dad.
Yep.
I mean, a normal 7-year-old will come up to your waist, maybe a little higher than that. As a little kid, he was like knee high to his
dad. Yep.
I mean, they, obviously impressionistic, it's style of animation and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But if his dad seemed that much larger than life to little Jack, what did Aku seem like? Aku must have been unknowably monstrous.
Yep.
And when he turns around and sees this, it's like, am I even seeing this? What?
Yep.
Something that should be pointed out here too is, in the same way as I felt it was a really fun thing to see a middle-aged hero, in this case, we have a hero in Jack that is not a poor farm boy.
Oh yeah, yep.
He's not a farm boy on Tatooine, you know, he's not a poor beggar kid that is discovered, he doesn't pull the sword from the stone, he's born of privilege. He's raised in the palace. He yep. is well fed. He is on track to be well trained. He has loving parents. He has a nice warm place. He's obviously got lots of stuff around him. He was not uneducated probably, but it was an intensive education. You don't need to be when you're 6 or 7 in that society. But this is a hero that's coming in his childhood from privilege. And
although
so did the Emperor.
In a certain way, unlike the Emperor, it's like he's being raised without the intention that he would even have his own life to the degree that an emperor does. Because an emperor
That's true, yeah.
doesn't really live their own life either.
Yeah, power is a prison.
But
yeah.
Jack really didn't have his own life. It was planned from the beginning that if this thing shows back up, Jack has to lose all of that. He's not going to have a childhood. He's not going to have an adulthood. He's going to be turned into a weapon to kill Aku. That's it. That's what it has to be. It has to be my descendant using this sword made from my soul.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be done like this.
And notice he didn't have any siblings either.
Oh, yeah.
He was old enough to have had, you know, at least one sibling. So here's to magical birth control, whatever they have in that world. But
yeah,
it's not like they probably didn't think about having other children. I mean, as an emperor, you wouldn't want to put all your genetic, you know, eggs in one basket. But I think he knew there was something special about this son. Like you said, this son was born when the evil was upon them. This son had some sort of magical resonance with it.
The same day that Aku gained his sentient existence, that evil Tar became someone instead of something.
Yes.
Was the same day that Samurai Jack, or whatever his real name is.
Yeah, he never mentions the kid's name. He just calls him my son. He doesn't.
Yep. So, the same day that Aku gets his person, Jack is born.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a lot of ways, we're seeing that yin and yang thing. That intended duality in the show is being repeated in this way too. Not exactly as expressly as some of the other ways where we see Aku all white. or rather, Jack all white, Aku all black against a red background as they intended, you know?
Yeah.
Where it's very clear there's this type of duality, but there's also the day that the evil was born was also the day that the thing that must destroy that evil was born. So.
And Jack's pretty pure of heart in this case. Like, there was no corruption going on. The people were good. The kingdom was good. There was not a lot of internecine struggle. As we mentioned last time, whatever clans there were had already sworn fealty to the emperor. There's one sigil, that cool little thing with the square and the lines that we ruthlessly stole for our logo. that because the evil was around, it resonated with Jack, making him good and pure and better than he might ordinarily have been. And like that, because of the supernatural undertones that Aku has, that makes perfect sense in a mythological in a fairy tale story sense. Yeah. So all of this happens, and immediately they, you know, these guys slide onto the scene and start shooting yep. arrows and throwing spears as if that would work. Like, didn't you read The Wall? Didn't you see this your whole life when you were being trained as kids that, you know, these things don't work? And Aku, of course, just goes, sucks them up and machine guns them back because yep. he remembers how this goes.
Yeah, at this point, he's got a little bit of experience under his belt.
And he immediately makes a beeline for the Emperor, who he's got a particular thing against, naturally.
Well, yeah, I mean...
But as he grabs him, and poor Jack is, like, witnessing all of this horror happening around him, he screams to his wife and says...
Mother, Aku has returned. Do as we have planned. Our future depends on it.
Get him out of here. Get him to a place he needs to be.
Plan B.
Plan B.
Plan B.
Activate what we talked about.
Yep.
Which is, we talked about a little at the end, but now we see the full range of what the Emperor's brilliant plan was. And it's pretty brilliant. He sent out envoys, apparently, all over the world. And to all different mishmash times.
Yeah, we're clearly looking at an alternate version, you know.
But it's like, there's everything from 1500 BC to 1200 AD. Like,
yeah.
It's a total free-for-all for every heroic thing you can think of. So at this point, you know, the mom grabs the sword, grabs the kid, books it, gets out as fast as she can. Now, Aku, having never seen them, doesn't know what they look like. Doesn't know who they are.
He doesn't know anything about them.
He might smell the blood of who Jack is later, but it's such a minuscule, tiny amount compared to the fact that he's holding the Emperor in his grip, literally. He's not concerned about the son getting away. He's concerned about wreaking vengeance upon the man that planted him.
Right. As far as he knows, this is the one thing that can do that to him. Seal him away. Send him off to whatever other stuck until another blah number of years and comes out and everything's changed again. Mm-hmm. Like, that can't happen again. So he goes for the Emperor first, of course.
And they sail. They make it out to a boat that is rigged with sails with the family crest on it.
Isn't that interesting, though? Because this attack has probably been going on for at most 30 minutes. You know, we only saw like 15 seconds of it. But we'll say 30 minutes. And that boat was already there. The boat that was planned. So does that mean the Emperor has patrols of boats out in the sea that all have the order like, hey... Someday this might happen, and the nearest guy needs to get here, you know, fast.
I think probably something like that, because it shows they're near the seashore, but there's a river,
I believe,
because we saw the river going through town, so they're probably on a river near the sea. That would be a good trading port. That would be a good place for a settlement to build your new city. And it shows that there was not a whole lot around. They were out in the middle of the ocean. I don't think they were near shore with that. They had to paddle a while.
Oh, yeah.
I think they just paddled out until they saw a patrol ship.
Whatever the patrol ship was.
Like, they just had to get away and get away from the shore, get over the horizon, get past where Aku could see them.
Mm-hmm.
And it would make sense if the Emperor had a navy. They'd be sailing up and down the coast to patrol the coast. Yeah.
They, as they were sailing away, we can see these sort of a very stylized impression of Aku over the castle, and as they get further away, it gets less and less specific, like what's really happening. And I remember we sort of came to the same sort of impression, like, hey, this is probably more like what Jack is remembering of his childhood. Again,
yeah, true.
We're not being shown very specific animations of what happens, And most of the time when we see Jack fight Aku, we see specifically what's happening. And not these, like, these sorts of... Yeah, it's definitely Jack's impression of what happened when he was a kid.
It's almost like a twisted version of the story he saw on the wall. because the story he saw on the wall was also impressionistic and done by the Empire's best artists. Naturally, had neat swirly clouds and cool looking, you know, their faces were like curved with it. It looked like samurai art, like you could find online.
Yeah, Yukio-A.
And this one of Aku just looked outsized and weird, like a nightmare. Like Aku was not in proportion.
Right.
And everything about Jack's life was out of proportion at that point.
Yeah.
His dad was gone, maybe dead. His mom was fleeing with him away from the only home he had ever known. And it all happened immediately. And he's struggling with this. He's crying. And he's pretty reserved for a little kid. I mean, most seven-year-olds seeing their father grabbed by a demon would be hysterical.
Yeah.
And this kid is just sort of quietly sobbing. Probably that samurai notion of repressing your emotions and, you know, being cool, not revealing anything. And probably
we don't see too much out of him.
But look at how reserved his father was. He probably wanted to emulate that. I have to be strong for mom. A lot of little kids do that in the face of disaster. So they get on the boat, which is a really nicely, it's not quite a junk. And it's not quite an Eastern or a Western sailing ship. It's kind of a cross.
Yeah,
it's like
if the
Japanese or Chinese had discovered things like pulleys and forecastles and things, they would have built a boat like that.
Right.
But since it's a fantasy world, okay, I'll buy it. And the captain's actually very nice, and he begins the child's education.
Yeah.
Immediately on the boat.
We see him learning to sail by the constellations.
Which is nifty.
And, yeah, that's we know just from remembering watching this ages ago that this comes in handy all the time. Now, they may not specifically be showing the constellations again, like, oh yes, he's following this one, but we know now why he's able to sail in all manner of boats and find his way without compass, without any like sailing equipment. He's being taught by this guy sailing by the stars, right.
And if you notice, too, the Orion-ish looking warrior is similar, not exactly, but similar in aspect to how his father's drawing was.
Oh, yeah?
That's sort of the sword thrust with the, you know, except he had a club. But it was very like, oh, okay, obviously they took their inspiration from the stars and whatever the astrology happens to be in that world. But, yeah, he was very patient with him, sat down, you know, pointed up and said, look at this constellation, and they sailed on. And this is just the first part of all of the shit that Jack learns. And Jack, at this point, is now in a fucking crash course.
Yeah.
Like, now it's real, and you're the hero that Gotham needs, and you need to spend some time in Ra's al Ghul's pit, figuratively. So, okay, so he goes from, let's see, astronomy on the ship, definitely, and they were sailing for months, so he learned enough of that to internalize some of it. And it's shown that as powerful as his father was and as diplomatic as his father was to set all this up, Jack is naturally intelligent. Jack gets it. Jack intuits things. He's definitely got a nudge up on his father that way, and definitely several notches up on Aku. Jack is smart.
Oh, yes. And he's a quick learner.
Very. Yeah, if he does something once or twice, he figures it out. And that's kind of a hallmark of the series, too, right up until the last episode with the baby. Like, every time Jack has this challenge that pushes him farther than just regular slashing at robots, he learns something new.
Yep.
And he learns it in the course of that combat, and he adapts. And it's really cool to see this. Like, that's what heroes do. They level up. They learn new techniques. You know, in the words of the developers of Dark Souls, get good. and Jack does. So, let's see. He goes on to Arabia, right? And there's these cool onion-looking domes. Or, like, sultanate-looking things. And there's a dude who looks like a cooler cartoon version of Jasmine's father in
yeah, okay,
Disney's Aladdin. So, and he's going to teach, you know, they at that point in time, if you're going to look at it being BC or Middle Ages, that, you know, horses could live quite nicely there, and they were good desert horsemen, you know, Lawrence of Arabia style. So they put him in a corral and they take him through age-old customary horse training. And they teach him just how to stay on the horse's back. And then they start saying, okay, now you can go move faster. And now we're going to teach you to stand up on it and learn balance so that you're capable of even standing up in the saddle.
Right.
And the kid is just totally adept and picking it all up very well. And at this point, the Sultan's like, I've taught him enough. I'm going to talk to my brother Mufasa out in the belt. And we trade with them many times. And we see they trade with them. There's a caravan.
Yeah, we can see that clearly. It's been what? 2 or so years? Maybe like a little over one.
Yeah, a year, maybe two. He's still a little kid. He's not a tiny child. He's definitely a larger child.
Yeah, he's gained knees. He now has those knees. Very useful.
He now has knees.
So
he's not just a robe anymore.
Exactly.
A big head on a robe.
And we see, like you said, he's going with the trade caravan. They travel out of the Fertile Crescent and down to what I can only imagine is Ethiopia. Because when they get there, and we'll see later as it goes on, its geographical position is almost certainly like Nubia, Ethiopia, whatever you'd like to call it, whatever it is in this version of Earth's timeline, which is really weird. And that region has had a few renamings. So, you know.
Over the centuries and conquerors.
It's what we would know as Ethiopia.
Isn't that where the Nile starts?
Yes, it is.
So it's probably also pretty fertile. This is why they're such successful tribesmen. They've actually built houses and their village is semi-permanent. Like, they're not hunter-gatherers. They have actually a working village with lots of people in it.
So yeah.
They're fairly rich. And this man who's leading is definitely a talented and successful elder. That's what you get from, look at his bearing. He's like shoulders back.
Yeah.
He white
stands
beard.
Proudly. Yeah.
And this is where we first start seeing Jack get some combat training.
Oh yeah. With
light combat training, not deadly stuff with a sword, just a stick. But that's kind of enough, you know?
Yeah, we see him, they teach him a couple different types of pole or quarterstaff, staff-related training. Blunt object training. And we're not there yet, but they do end up fleshing out that time in Jack's life a little bit more.
Oh, cool.
Later on in the series, really loved that episode, so can't wait to get to that and sort of compare this episode to that one. But for now, we just see the basics of them doing the staff training.
And we see Jack, like, fighting back. Like, at first he's defensive, and then you can tell there's this look of intensity in his face. He's like, aha, bam. And it kind of startles him for a minute, and he blocks it.
Yep.
Oh, good job, kid. You're learning.
Yep. You know what a moment of vulnerability looks like.
Uh-huh. Jack intuited that just from stick fighting with the dude for a while. Like, again, more proof that Jack is very smart.
Yeah, very quick learner, that guy.
Let's see. From there, they go on to ancient Egypt. So back another 1,500 years to ancient Egypt, where there are hieroglyphics, and he's very clearly learning about writing, like specifically how to scribe things.
Oh, and I want to point out, they ran the whole way. Jack is a little kid, and he ran the whole way.
Hundreds of miles.
Up the Nile River.
The Nile River.
So at this point, Jack is already getting some pretty intense physical training.
Oh God, yes.
He is easily the greatest child in the world at this point. He's like,
he's already started. I mean, even at zero level, Jack has got the capability of, again, this is a proof that you need later for, well, how can he just keep fighting robots all the time? Like, how can he just keep this up? Well, because he ran the length of the Nile River.
Yeah.
To get to Memphis or Cairo.
Second stage training, or rather third.
Third stage training, yeah. Where he was probably 11, 12-ish at this point, to get him to Egypt. And here is where he gets a little bit of a break. So he gets to learn from all of the great scholars in Egypt. So he probably learns a little bit of first aid. He probably learns what kind of food is good to eat where. He definitely learns how to write. So, and then as it pans up, it kind of gives us this nice segue into...
Oh, I just wanted to point out one more thing about the Egypt thing.
Oh, yes.
Like Samurai Jack's time in Africa...
It's adventure time, man.
Yeah, there we go. Back in adventure time. maybe we'll steal some content from them too.
There are no noodly arms in this.
Oh, yeah.
Until much later.
Like I said, we have knees in this show. But, like I said, the Egypt part, we actually see that expanded upon in another episode later too. So we'll get a better idea of what his training and what he was focused on in that time later.
Good.
And I think I think a large part of what he learned in Egypt was restraint. And we'll see that, like, it's all about, like, restraint and knowing, like, when it's okay. And that's, well, like I said, we'll get into that when that episode comes, but I do think this was actually an important part of his journey. And then, like you're saying, he moves on from there.
And it fades up into ancient Greece, which is 500 or 800 years after that, kind of, I think. So, you know, he goes from 2,500 years ago to 1,500 years ago, whenever ancient Greece was around, 800 BC. And there he's probably learning more combat arts, but also I'm going to suggest that he also learns how forms of government work. Like he's seeing how ancient Greek does stuff. Like this dovetails into, hey, he could be emperor someday. The emperor probably would have set that up to say, you know, not only do I want you to learn a non-lethal, you know, he's learning the most non-lethal form of fighting, you know, with a stick.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're not going to kill, they might bruise each other with the sticks they were fighting with. They weren't going to kill each other. Wrestling, not going to kill each other. It's about defeating an opponent and it's about internalizing what a warrior does and how you have to fight to win and how you have to fight with integrity. Because both of those in the stick fighting and in the wrestling is all about engaging with your opponent in order to establish an honorable victory.
Right.
Like both of these would have satisfied the honor of an Eastern emperor, but both of these kinds of fighting styles would have in his estimation. So he learns how to wrestle, which is a nice little cutscene where he's wrestling the dude. And
although I do think that what we're seeing with, like you said, it's fighting for honor,
mm-hmm.
and it has set rules that mean you have either won or lost. And I think that's where we see a lot of his. In later episodes, we see him get insulted by Aku not following
any rules,
anything honorable, not going along.
What's he
gonna
do?
I mean, with his own rules, like promising things, you know, making deals and breaking them. For Jack, a lot of his early education was steeped in honor, and that's probably why we see him get actually insulted. Even though, come on. You were fighting with the Shogun of Sorrow. You were fighting with
Shape-shifting Master of Darkness. What did you expect?
He's evil. His name is the word evil. And you're like,
I spelled it out anymore.
I can't believe you didn't, you know, go along with your promise. Person whose name means evil.
Shocking.
This is probably where his, like, strong sense of honor and believing that you fight in a certain way and when you win, you've won, you know?
That is the whole idea of honor, both Eastern and Western, was set up as a control. It was set up as a method of ethics that would allow people who were much stronger, much better trained, wielded the power of life and death literally in their hands on just about every other human that they would meet, except another warrior. A system of honor is designed to teach the warriors restraint, to let them have some way of understanding empathy for their opponents. If all you are is a killer and a soldier that just kills things, then okay, you're a soldier. You know, soldiers kill people. Psychopaths kill people. Warriors, a lot of times, have codes of ethic. Because when they're fighting, they're very well trained, they understand how much power they wield, and they understand who that power is being used for. So even whether it's a medieval knight, whether it's a member of the samurai caste, like his father probably was.
If you were a samurai, that meant you were underneath a lord.
Or even tribal peoples, Native Americans even had a sense of honor that kind of tracked with that, you know, if you wrestled somebody to the ground and were able to defeat them, this is a lot of times how the tribes would, you know, reconcile disputes.
Especially after the law of peace was brought.
Mm-hmm. Like we mentioned, there we have these things where we are trying very hard to find a way for us to settle a dispute so everyone feels like the dispute was settled without actually slaughtering all of these humans.
Mm-hmm.
And honor was, I guess, a primitive and yet then developed manner by which those ethics could be propagate it. And not everybody followed them, and not all the time, and there weren't that many. And sometimes it was, you know, like pirates, more of a guideline.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
he's like, learning it anyway. He's learning what the rules are so he can break them later if he needs to. And in this case, every series of honor that he would have had, Eastern, or the tribesman's honor, or the honor that the Egyptians had for their gods and for their infrastructure and their priesthood and whatnot,
yes,
or the Greeks' love of logic and their forums and how citizens had representation. He was learning about all of these forms, about how people should interrelate at a very high level. This is what an emperor's kid should learn.
Yeah.
And the emperor set all that up.
Because the emperor spent his whole... he might not be able to do that at home.
Yes. I have a feeling even if Jack had reached... when Jack reached an age of majority, I have this feeling that the emperor would have sent him anyway.
And maybe that's possible.
Maybe gone with him. Maybe overseen some of it as he took him around to these places. But I think the emperor would not have let that go without Jack getting some kind of training before he assumed a rulership. But not then, not at 7. That was way too early for that kid to have to face that kind of shit. But when he did, all of these people that the emperor spent so long putting together worked. Okay, so moving on from the Greeks, we see that, you know, he's a mid-teen now, and he headed north to the northern part of Europe, so British Islands, and there he meets what can only be described as Robin Hood.
Yep.
And I love how they drew him in, but they didn't say it was Robin Hood. There was nothing there there was no, you know, Little John or anything. There was a rich noble who had a purse of gold, and the dude was wearing the green.
Yep.
The green thing, the green frock that they always put Robin Hood in, in all the old movies. And he had this awesome, like, pointy hat and pointy beard. Like, Robin Hood was made of triangles, like arrow points.
Yeah. And, well, you know.
But he learned archery, and he learned a different... this is, I think, where you were talking about, where would he learn how to not play by the rules? This might have been one of the first times that he did, because they were criminals.
That's true.
Robin Hood and his merry band of thieves. They stole from the rich and gave to the poor. Like, here's a way of realizing your honorable ethics when the government doesn't work. And you can still be an honorable fighter without having a standard, you know, a big Egyptian government, a big Greek government, whatever, to do this.
Right.
Or even a mighty tribal elder teaching you what. Like, they had a leader, but this guy was just there to teach him how to be a good archer and maybe show him that people who seem to be bad, who are said to be thieves and awful, are actually quite good. They're doing the best they can in a bad situation, but he still made friends with those people. And I'm wondering if his dad didn't get there and originally want him to train with whoever the local lord was at the castle.
Oh, yeah, it's possible.
But when he got there, he found out the government was all corrupt.
Yeah, I mean,
and like, ran into Robin Hood instead.
Most of the people that his dad set him up to be trained by were... in some way, a political leader, you know? They ruled a certain section of land.
Mm-hmm.
And really what we see when he goes to Europe is he's learning from somebody who's basically a local robber, you know? Like, part of some local robbing gang, you know? Maybe they were, you know, like, in some kind of a Robin Hood type of
thing. They wore hoods to rob, is what you're saying here.
I'm saying they might have been hood-wearing robbers.
Hmm. Although he had a really nice hat. I liked the hat. The hat was very spiky. I liked the hat.
Oh, yep.
I'd wear a hat like that if it wouldn't poke out my friend's eyes.
But yeah, I mean, I think while he doesn't necessarily seem to be stealing to eat or stealing to feed himself, which are two of the exact same thing, stealing for himself,
for personal
we don't
gain.
See that very often. And when we do, which we'll see later, it generally has really bad spiritual consequences for him. But
he holds himself to a very high standard, and a lot of samurai held themselves to, if they could manage to do so without being thrown into complete chaos because every single lord around them was at war, they did try to adhere to some of it, just like knights kind of sort of tried to hold to it.
We get a strong idea that at least in this situation, he's being exposed to and at least taught archery by somebody who disagrees with the law and doesn't listen to a single word of it.
But doesn't matter. What biology matters. Biology doesn't care. Biology says you have to learn how to shoot a bow really good, and these people are really good.
Yep.
And it builds on other stuff that he learned. So, you know, he learned balance. He learned how kinetics work with his body in wrestling. And now he's learning to put that together to shoot a bow, an English longbow. From there, they move on to Viking land across the sea, which I wish they would have shown more of this.
Yeah.
Because they had Thor was one of the gods. I mean, this was a great place to at least call back a little bit to one of the gods. But they had just showing them sailing on a ship. And European sailing and Viking sailing and Polynesian South Sea Island sailing, all of these had different approaches to how to get around on water. And what we see of the Vikings was they just, you know, balls first. Whoosh. Yep. Who cares? It's the North Sea. We don't give a shit.
Yeah, we're Vikings. We're used to this now.
Yeah. It's a boat. It's fun.
But,
you gotta puke over the side.
Yeah. I thought it was really good though, because we're sort of seeing that Jack is learning to sail from more than one person. And we're going to see throughout the series him using that knowledge of navigating the oceans and the seas.
That's true. He's in little boats a lot, isn't he?
Like
three or four times at least that he's in his own little boat. Minimum, he's in his own little boat.
Yep.
And you're wondering, how the hell is he getting anywhere? Like, he doesn't seem to have, there's no motors on these things, even though there's robots in this world. Apparently, there's no little, you know, Evinrude motorboat thing you can put on it. But, he seems to intuit sailing the same way he picked up intuiting fighting.
Yeah, but it's just
natural to him.
I think as we go on, we're going to see situations where he naturally drifts back to sailing. And I think that is chiefly because of his past in sailing. So we're going to see that later. And when we do see one of the, like, biggest, there has to be a reason why he chose to come back and do this now.
Mm-hmm.
When we get to that point, I'm thinking it's in this episode when we see not only from his own people, but also from the Vikings and possibly others, he's been learning about their version of sailing.
Yeah, he is. So whatever he finds himself, he has an approach that can adhere to that based, you know, no matter what tech level he finds himself at. He has a set of tools about how to approach this. Well, if I can't look at the stars, then I can use this kind of thing. Well, if I have a big sailing vessel, then we can go this way. But if I only have a little raft or a boat, then I can use more of the Viking idea. Like, he's got an idea of any size of craft based on these experiences, which is, that's great. Again, that's another explanation for how is Jack a hero? And when we see him do stuff later in the series, how can we prove that he knows how to do this? Oh, well, right back here. You can intuit it from his training. Then he moves on to, I believe, the Russian steppes.
Yep.
Where they throw axes at matryoshka dolls, I think they're called.
Yes.
The nesting dolls. That's pretty clever. The nesting dolls,
you know, just so you know for sure, it's definitely Russia. It's
definitely mother Russia. And the guy's got the big poofy pants and the big Russian beard. Which is, that's really cool. Yep. Like that's an image of Russia that doesn't get shown very often. The traditional.
But hey, I mean, the throwing of weapons is important. It's actually one of the most important parts because if you remember, the emperor slew, or at least sealed, Aku using a thrown sword at the last Aku.
Which we didn't recommend doing, by the way.
Yeah, but hey, it worked.
It worked.
And here we are in Russia learning how to throw weapons.
It's like the thrown weapon is the Samurai Jack's version of the headbutt. Like, nobody expects it, and it's terribly effective. So then from there, naturally, they move to Mongolia to learn advanced horsemanship. Horsemanship 501. So for his degree that he learns.
Great.
So he's combining skills here. What are the Mongolians known for? Fighting from horseback.
Yep.
So now he knows how to throw weapons. He knows how to use a bow. He knows how to balance on a horse because we saw him do that as a kid in Arabia. And all of these things fit together for advanced horse training. And with the Mongols, so he can fire a bow and throw a spear and do stuff like that from horseback with the Mongols.
Yep.
That completes an important part of his training and integrates other pieces that he's learned. So that was a cool shot there. They don't spend too long on these last few. Then from there, of course, he keeps moving eastward into China, where he learns with Shaolin monks. And that's one of the cooler little sequences because that's right out of a Saturday afternoon kung fu double feature right there. Where they're doing the sit-ups with the sponges. I remember the movie. I can't remember the movie that came from, but I've seen that in an old 1970s Kung Fu movie where they're showing how they trained them. They just had them emptying one bucket with a sponge, doing a huge body sit-up, and filling another bucket. And when they're done, they hop down, switch the buckets. And it's that's cool because it doesn't just make you mindlessly do it. You have to concentrate on doing something else while you're doing a sit-up. So you're upside down, you have to soak the sponge. And then you have to sit up with the sponge and squeeze it out over here. You're like, you're moving more the muscles than just your abdomen muscles. That's a good training thing. Then he integrates all of his weapons training here. Just like he integrated the horse training in the bows, now he's integrating the sword style he was learning as a child, the stick fighting with the spear that he was learning from Mufasa out in the desert. He's learning how to keep his balance and flip over things in combat from the wrestling people. All of these things come together with the Shaolins. If they had sent him to the Shaolins first, he would have missed out on all those other things.
Yeah, I feel like
there was a specific order that he was going through these in.
Yeah.
Year by year. And as he was completing training, I'm sure they were sending messages ahead to the next group. Hey, we're ready to send him to you now.
Yeah, when we'll see more from the Shaolin later in
there's a time portal about them.
I just loved all the stuff from the Shaolin training because look, the animator from Samurai Jack, not Genndy Tartakovsky, but like his main man. He was a martial artist.
Yo, Jack's my main man. Have those kids from the next episode come in.
Specifically, he's like a big Shaolin. He loves wushu and he loves kung fu. And so this whole training sequence with the Shaolin monks, especially like the punching of the sand and everything.
Oh,
and
yeah,
like
that was said, another one out of a Saturday matinee, the sand punching.
Taking the water with the cup and putting it in the bucket, like you were saying, like that. All that, you know, that's just straight from the heart of that animator. He like loves that whole trope. So
lovely few weeks at work animating it.
Yeah. So we see that and we also see him training with them. He's using a pole arm against the other guy who's using a broadsword and they're doing beautiful, beautiful acrobatics with that. And the choreography is actually quite great. Again, because the animator is an experienced martial artist.
So he knows what that should look like and can stylize it effectively.
Yep.
But like I said, he learned how to fight with a stick when he was a kid. Like this is just adding on top of his other skills. He learned how to shoot with a bow with Robin Hood. And then he learned how to shoot from horseback, which he learned how to ride in Arabia when he was a kid. So, like, all the Shaolin monks were the most challenging. That was the most precise, the most demanding, the most disciplined of anything else that he had learned.
Yeah,
because everything else up to that point was hard, and he was definitely being trained, but the Shaolin monks were just fucking laser-perfect discipline. You need that to adhere to the quality standard of fighting that those people have. It's an art, it's a spiritual expression, it's everything you've learned up to this point.
Yep.
So, at this point, he's finally ready to go meet his mom, after more than 10 years of being away. And he dresses up in a big old Tibetan fur coat, and trudges up the side of a beautifully animated mountain with snow swirling everywhere.
Which we're assuming is in Tibet, but who really knows? Because
it's
this timeline is weird.
It's a Tibetan hat, Matt. That's if I know anything about my cartoons, that is a Tibetan hat. And a big bell-shaped Tibetan.
Oh, okay.
Llama wool, whatever they have. Yeah. Because I've seen lots of cartoons, and that's what they all wear.
All right.
Yeah.
The voice of cartoons has spoken.
That's true because I just said so. So when he finally gets in and his mother has been probably following his training, like she's been getting little bits.
Or at the very least been getting letters about it. Yeah.
From people, hey, we've just sent him along to. And she's been biding her time and she's old now and bearing the weight of the years and missing the two people in the world she loves most. Her husband and her son are both gone for probably at least half of her life at this point. That, you know, she had her husband for a short time, you know, a few years, maybe 5 or 6 years. And then when the wars were done and he had unified his kingdom and his empire, they decided to have a baby. And she got to have the baby for a few years until he was a little kid. And then they both disappeared. Yep. And she had to go. And for the next 10 or 11, 12 years, nothing. So Jack arrives and he's, I'm going to say he's like 19 or 20.
We're looking at a probably about 20-year-old Jack.
He's definitely an adult of stature at this point. Broad shoulders, tall, strong, I mean, muscled. He is a young but proud first-level fighter at this point. And she is just overwhelmed, happy to see him, gives him a big hug, and then fetches his father's sword.
I also love the fact that he identified himself by showing the insignia.
The old tattered insignia that he kept with him that whole time.
Yeah, long after his actual, like, robe had been destroyed. Because we saw over the course of all those like sequences of training that his robes were getting torn up, and eventually by the end they were gone.
Mm-hmm.
And
but this isn't the first or the last time that Jack will lose his robes, because they really liked animating there for the ladies, that's, or the gay guys, whoever liked looking at Jack like that.
But they, you know, they give him a replacement set of clothes in this scene. We see him reunited with the sword and going through a few routines with it.
Is this where we show that he gets his white robes from? Was this the first white robes that he got?
Oh, well, he had them to begin with, but they got new broken ones. Down.
Yeah.
And then he got these new ones now.
So he's literally a fighter on the side of light.
Yep.
And he is a warrior with a strong ethical base, a strong physical training base. He's in peak physical form. He is now worthy of this weapon. Just like his father was. He is now a young, inexperienced, and yet still a hero in his own right from having gone through these trials and reached through his training. So he gets to use the sword, accepts him, and this is what the sword can be used for. And it feels right. He's running through these routines like, pff, pff, like, no problem. This thing is perfect. And at this point, he decides, time to face Aku. Yep. So we go to commercial break. I know we spent a really long time in this training, but the training part is really important to understanding who Jack is. They showed us these things.
And it comes back so many times.
Yeah, it was his life. It was his whole childhood, his whole remembered life before he was a small child. We only flash back to his childhood a few times over the course of the series where he remembers being a boy. And this time was not really focused. He doesn't really bring it up a lot. He remembers a lot of his training a lot more than he remembers being that little kid with a wooden sword.
Yeah.
So after the break, we open on the absolute hellscape that Aku has fashioned to feed on the rich misery of the populace. And if you notice, he tortures them. He keeps them barely subsistenced, but he's not necessarily killing them. He's just making them really miserable. And having them do useless things and only giving them barely enough food to live, and they're half starved and they're wearing rags because Aku needs to sop up as much of that sweet, sweet misery as he can.
Yeah, that's power. I mean, we can even see, like, the stuff that he has them do is almost always meaningless. Like, they're clearly just being made to suffer for the sake of making them suffer, which means he has to be getting something out of it. So yeah, it could be that he just plain old feeds off of the pain and suffering.
And it's a supernatural absorption. They're not working to create, they're not mining, you know. He said they're mining in order to, his father, when he finds him, says they're using him to get our resources, and he's using us to, you know, take everything from our land that made it good. But there's others who are just made to do what they're doing just in order to farm their misery. Just to absorb that. In my headcanon, a lot of stuff that I've seen seems to track pretty well to that. So when he goes in and tries to find his dad, there are these bizarre looking guards swathed in red and black, I guess.
Well, before we even get to that, we see that there's an old man turning a very large totem pole with Aku's face. It doesn't do anything else except spin Aku's face around in a circle.
So everyone see him.
And one thing I wanted to point out, because when I saw it, I was like, oh, this is the exact same way that Aku's face turned around at the beginning of the episode when he was reborn.
that centerline pivot.
He spins around and you see his face turning again. So that was obviously sort of a callback to the beginning of the episode. Like, hey, remember, this is that horrifying thing that appeared. And at the same time, there's no point to this except to make the Emperor miserable. He's the only one pushing this.
Mm-hmm.
He's just pushing this giant wooden totem pole around in a circle alone.
For God knows how long.
Yep.
Like, he could have been there for years. Clearly the man is broken.
Yeah.
And he's only, what, I'm going to say in his 50s. Like, he's not that old. If we call him in his mid-40s, when he fought Aku the first time, as a, you know, even late 40s, as a leveled emperor, you know, a hero in his own right, he is a broken shell of who that man was. Whatever Aku does to pull misery and whatever out of people and suck their life force out, he has pulled a lot out of the emperor, to the point where the emperor is the shriveled old husk of who he used to be. He's even shorter. He has no muscles, nothing. You can hardly believe it's the same guy.
And we see that he crumbles from the work, and one of his former, I guess, country women cries out,
"Here's some water, my emperor."
And the guards, as you mentioned, cloaked in red and completely shaded in black, you know, whip the water out of her hand and says,
"None for him!"
And that's when we see Jack appear.
Water, water, water.
I said no water!
And Jack destroys them in such a way that the Emperor knows the instant he sees that blade in the hand of that man, it's his son.
It can only be my son.
He has returned.
Oh, and it's worth noting, when Jack kills those guys, they just turn to smoke. They just disappear.
At first I thought that was bits of Aku, but it didn't act like the bits of Aku that inhabited the armor that his dad was fighting.
Right.
It just looked like smoke.
Burn away like the film.
Mm-hmm. And it didn't aggregate and slither away.
Yeah.
It didn't attempt to rejoin itself with the main body of Aku. It just went and evaporated. So either that was a spell of some sort, or those used to be people.
Yeah.
We don't know.
Somehow, one way or another, there were these people that looked like they were somehow partially Aku or had some Aku-based influence. So,
It reinforces, as he's doing this, that's like, okay, Aku is supernatural. Again, there's not a lot of technological stuff around here. Aku is using very basic means to extract the misery that he's looking for.
We can see that Aku has the power to at least to either create people that are black like him or turn people into the vaguely him-like things. Because they seemed to... It's almost like they definitely related to the humans, you know, because they were trying to torture him. They understood the water, you know, and they were speaking in the proper language, too.
Yeah.
They weren't just hissing and, you know, making an evil-looking face to keep her from giving the... Yeah, they were clearly speaking. So, like Aku, they have human characteristics.
Yeah, and if you had a construct like that, it would be very useful as an evil guard. It would never have to sleep. It wouldn't have to eat. It wouldn't consume any materials. It's awake all the time. Like I said, it would be constantly aware all the time of what's going on around it. You couldn't fool it. You couldn't corrupt it. You couldn't bribe it. You couldn't give it an extra ration of water and have it look away so you could go visit your family on the other side of the pit. You know, it didn't, they were basically there to keep the people in line. And for a trained hero like, you know, a baby hero like Jack, they were nothing. They were absolutely zero level mooks to kill. And so, he did. Whack, whack, whack. That sword went through them like nothing.
So we see them reunited. And right away, Jack pretty much states his intention.
"Do not worry, father. For with the power of this sword, I will vanquish Aku, sending him back into the pit of hate from which he came."
And the emperor slaps the sword out of his hand. And this is why I think, in some ways, Jack is not yet worthy. He's not quite ready, because the emperor is saying, like, hey, you know,
"I thought once like you, but the sword is only a tool. What power has it compared to the hand that wields it? Evil is clever, and deception is its most powerful weapon. Let the sword guide you to your fate, but let your mind set free the path to your destiny.
I realized it's the person more than it is the sword, you know, and we see, when we hear that, it pretty much explains why he put his son through all that.
Yeah.
It's, I've got to forge the perfect person to destroy Aku.
Yeah.
Not the perfect sword. We already tried that.
No, they have the perfect sword. Now they just need the person that can wield it at least as well, if not better than me. Like, I'm trying to forge my son into something that can defeat Aku for good, not just plant him again.
But the sword, if he doesn't make the right person, if Jack isn't worthy, if he's not ready, the sword is meaningless. And he makes a point of that by saying, deception is evil's most powerful tool. The sword is useless against deception. The sword can be made actually a tool of evil through deception. So he definitely wants to reaffirm to Jack, like, no, you're thinking about this all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we, you know, don't even give him a chance to trick you, to distract you or anything like that. It's got to be you more than the sword.
Because Jack says something about this, you know, with this sword, I will. Like,
yep.
Like we quoted. But when his father also knows, like, I almost failed. In my hubris, when we see what's echoed in that statement, and what he's actually saying underneath that, in my hubris, I wrote out thinking that I could just defeat this evil with the magic that I had, and it didn't work. And I almost lost everything. So you need to not be tricked. You need to not have hubris. You need to use everything that you've learned about honor, everything you've learned about restraint, everything you've learned about integrity.
Yep.
Because if you don't have that in at least as strong a measure as Aku has evil, he's gonna wipe the floor with you no matter what you have. And that's true. Like, he doesn't want his son to have to sit there and fight 100 men that Aku ate and then became.
Yeah.
he wants his son to have a better time of this.
Yeah.
And reminding him that it's all about your own personal worth here. It's all about your training. It's all about the investment in you.
And he also ends it off. Don't underestimate Aku. He said,
be wary, my son, for evil finds a way.
So he's telling Jack, the person that will be named Jack.
We still don't know his name. No one ever says it. It's hilarious.
It's always son, all these years, emperor, and mother. But
what's your name anyway, boy? And he just shows them a little sigil.
Yeah. Oh,
pointy circle, we'll call you that.
But yeah, not the evil badass, finds a way. You know, don't underestimate him. And we get this incredible scene where it's Jack riding against a red sunrise.
Ah, that's beautiful.
And the Taiko jumps are going nuts, you know. really creative Taiko drum music going on in the background with lots of different tones and stuff being put into play. And one way or another, he arrives at Aku's tower thing, which I feel like we almost saw the beginnings of in the stump itself. Like, the tower and the way it looks and the original, like, thing that he attached the emperor to, all that stuff has a certain look to it. It all harkens back to one another.
Yeah. That same form factor.
It's like, yeah.
The pillar with the spiky bits coming out is kind of Aku's signature.
And Jack goes up to the entrance and screams,
Aku!
And we see, when he does that scream, it zooms away from him in Aku's lair. And we see that the absence of flames around Jack actually has the shape or the form of flames itself. So there's almost this appearance of an aura around Jack, this clearing out of the fire that's been placed here, frozen here by Aku.
Like he's anti-fire. He's cold fire. Like,
oh boy.
He's light fire. So he walks in and the cinematography says, nope, this is the good guy. This right here, this is the good guy.
And Aku rises out of the pit of hate, referenced by the Emperor. Rises out of the pit of hate and he gives his introduction. At this point in the series, we can tell Aku still loves his job. He loves it.
That is one thing we can say. Yeah. Aku has a massive amount of job satisfaction.
Yeah.
No matter the heroes who bug him, the interstellar treaties he needs to betray, the despoiling of the planet, Aku, at his soul, really loves his job.
Yeah, I mean,
it's really who it's what he does and who he is, and that's something he can give to the world, I think.
Well, at this point, they seem to be suggesting he's only in control of Japan. Right now, he's controlled the island that he was born on.
Yeah, it's taken a few years to get
and
where it was.
In this point, administrative duties are not overwhelming yet. They don't take up most of his time. Whereas we'll see later, he like spends lots of time later on talking to people from different planets, talking to people who want this and that, who want him to stop doing this and that, and even just like, oh, I guess I have to burn these guys away with laser fire again.
Again. This like, is getting boring. It is the fifth time this week.
But right now, life is good for Aku.
Skittles and beer, all the misery he can eat, a little kingdom full of lots of little humans.
Just listen to the way he talks to himself, you know? He talks about himself. He has like 12 different titles for himself at that point.
Thought them all up himself too.
Yeah, like he loves it. He loves being the Shogun of Sorrow.
Shifting Master of Darkness.
Yeah, he loves it. So, you know, he gives his whole introduction, and even though he smells on Aku or on Jack, the blood of his most hated enemy and that sword, which Jack swipes at him.
Well, he says, "You fool, no human weapon can hurt me." And Jack's just like, slash. And he does the same thing when he got slashed by Jack's dad.
Ah! Yeah.
Translation.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
That hurts. Surprisingly, that hurts.
Like, that never hurts. Oh, you have that blade.
Surprisingly, that hurts.
A reference we will talk about in a different podcast.
Yes. Alcor from Mass Effect.
but yes, so...
Dejectedly, it looks as if evil has taken us over.
The sword and the blood of his enemy, he basically talks about that for a second. And then what I think is interesting about what he said, he says he believes neither Jack nor the sword has the power to permanently destroy him.
That sword, I remember that blade. I recognize your blood. You are the son of the fool who imprisoned me those many years ago. No matter. Neither he nor the sword had the power to slay me forever, and neither do you.
I think, I'm pretty sure by the end of the series, he doesn't believe that anymore. He doesn't believe he's beyond the sword and Jack. I think quickly, even I think by the end of season one, he now gets like, wait, no, together they can destroy me.
But hubris, again, on his side, he nearly defeated the Emperor. And the Emperor was only able to stop him for a short time. And even that, after having the gods forge a blade out of his soul, the Emperor had to give a lot just to stop him for a while, for a few years, out of the million years he was here.
Yeah.
And the 6 or 8 years that he spent sentient but underground, and all it took was a freaking eclipse to bring him back awake. And we don't see any... I don't think we see any priests or anything like that. The intelligentsia has been more or less killed off. Like, they don't have astronomers. They don't have people whose only job it is to do magic and make green potions and study the stars. You didn't see that. That was going to be probably still training them up. They probably had to bring people in from outside to help with that.
Oh, yeah.
All of them died except for the few old men that were helping his wife.
Yeah, like I said, it clearly seems like... The Emperor expected this not to happen so quickly, that Aku would be sealed for a little bit longer than this.
Hopefully, at least until Jack was old enough to take him on as a guy. So when he finally gets there, I mean, they're having a full-on kung fu movie showdown.
Yeah.
They're calling each other out. They're threatening each other. They're saying things like, you will never defeat me. Yes, because I am the force of righteousness and I shall defeat you. Yep. Like they're doing a full on epic fairy tale samurai movie showdown.
Yep.
And it ends very unexpectedly.
Yeah,
looks like the good guy's just about to win. Looks like all of the Emperor's plans almost worked.
Well, here's what I'm thinking. So when we see Jack, he throws the sword at Bat Aku.
Oh God, never throw the sword.
He throws the sword. We all knew that training was coming back. So he throws the sword upwards and it seals Aku inside the sword. And unlike the Emperor, instead of sealing him away and waiting until they can regain their power, reorganize
the narrative,
he casts Aku back out of the sword and intends to kill him. He gives Aku another chance to do something because he knows he can kill him. He underestimated the power of evil.
Mm-hmm.
He underestimated Aku. And the moment that he didn't do the same thing his father did, just get rid of him. Get rid of him. We can do something about this later. Nope. He tried to do him in.
Look at how he learned to fight.
Yep.
He learned to fight honorably. Yep. I must allow my enemy a clear view to know now I shall vanquish you and I shall vanquish you with honor. And yep. You will die with honor. And Aku's like, I don't think so. If you notice, when they were fighting, Aku used the same forms he used to fight his dad.
Yeah.
Probably more or less the forms of all of the things that he ate up to that point. Bugs, bats, octopuses, crabs, whatever wandered into the pit over a million years.
It almost seems a lot of times like he's imitating, constellations.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Definitely the crab. That's Cancer.
Yep.
The bat, I'm not sure of.
I'm not sure. He seems like he's going after, he's these symbolic creatures every time.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't turn into the pterodactyl this time.
That's
he turned
true.
Into this yeah. bird type thing. So he's got these like, it's almost like he's got an impression of what Earth life is like, but it's not really close, and they all have that ridiculous face on it.
It's Aku's idea of what this form might have been.
Right.
Because that's all he's seen. And what does he care? He's a sociopath. Like,
yep.
He doesn't pay attention to shit like, art or form.
So, Aku flung him into the future where his evil is law.
He does this cool Hanna-Barbera. And like the rings come out of his mouth, like,
what trickery is this? Aku!
Do not worry, Samurai. You will see me again. But next time, you will not be so fortunate.
And he creates literally a vertical time portal. Probably something he had set up in the past, I think. Like, we were discussing this off mic at one point.
Yep.
We're like, what could Aku have done as a contingency against anyone that might have attacked him? Because he had as much time to plan as the Emperor did.
Yeah.
Like, what,
at this
what
point,
can
he's
I do?
Had more time than the Emperor had to prepare for the next attack from Aku.
Mm-hmm.
He had, the Emperor planned for about what? 5 or 6 years before Aku reappeared.
Yeah, Aku had 10 or 11.
Yeah, because we had to wait all those years for a Jack to grow up from what to me looks like he was 5 years old at most to a 20-year-old. He's had a lot of time to plan, to absorb power, and just try to be ready this time for the sword.
That's hard for Aku to do. If you notice, a lot of times, Aku's tactics are reactions.
Yep.
This might be one of the few times that Aku got outside of his own head and thought for a minute, how can I
do this?
Aku did the same thing to Jack that was done to him by the Emperor.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
He pushed the problem off.
In many ways, the Emperor sent Aku to the future. He said, you're coming back later and I'll deal with you when I'm ready. And Jack almost defeated Aku before he got a chance to put that fate back on that cursed blood.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack freed him. So what does he do? He says, now it's your turn, asshole.
Exactly. Aku used the tactics he was familiar with.
Right.
And one of the tactics that was used against him was the Emperor sealed me away. The Emperor neutralized me.
Sealed me away for all these years to get ready and prepare to destroy me.
Yeah.
And then Aku seals Jack away or sends him away, but it could even be that he's been sealed away. We don't understand how this time travel works. There could just be that portal there for a while, you know? Because when we come back in the next episode, we just see the portal spit him out.
Yeah.
It may have just been swirling there the whole time. You know, the way Aku runs laws, it could just be that people did not defy the law not to touch that thing, you know?
Yeah, because we don't know what it was. Maybe it was just a single singularity point in the sky, and he didn't have anything built around that, and in fact made sure there was a nice long drop under it. Like, if he even remembered that when... Yep. It didn't seem to me later on that Aku really knew exactly when Jack was going to reappear. He knew it was going to be far in the future, because he used the last of his power to do it. Aku was powerless after that. He was human-sized. He was weak. Like, when he talked, it was with a mumble. It wasn't with his usual hilarious laughter.
Yep.
It was like, no, I will be meeting you again. You know, we shall meet again in the future. But he used the same tactic. You're right.
Yep.
And it goes back to Aku isn't necessarily smart, but he's cunning, which means later on in the future, Aku gets a little bit more sophisticated.
Yeah.
With how he deals with minions and how he conquers quite clearly other very powerful Earth-based magic things.
And planets.
And whole planets worth. Yeah. But we can get to that in the next version. But the cool part is, like, Jack has no freaking clue what's happening to him. He's like, what? And it cuts him off as he just disappears. Boom. It was literally Aku's version of the samurai strike without warning. What is that in Japanese? I forgot.
Oh, but not sure. Let's see.
there's a name for the maneuver, which is basically you go from a ready position. You don't haul back or do anything. It's just pow, boom. You just hit their artery immediately. And the pointy end goes in the other man.
Yeah.
But you do it in such a way that the other person can't anticipate where it's going to come from or how fast you're going to move. You got to practice it a lot. This was Aku's backdoor. This was his way of, in case of samurai, pull lever. And that's what he did to send him into the future. Again, didn't kill him, but it puts the sword out of his time.
Yep.
And it puts the person who can wield it out of his time. And that's all Aku needed.
Yeah, it's very interesting, you know? Like I was saying before, this is the perfect revenge for Aku. Or at least from Aku's point of view, this is exactly what he wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
You know? Now that bloodline has suffered that crippling defeat that I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know? He's sealed away. He's sent to a place and trapped in a place that he can't save his family. He can't save his people. It's already over.
Yeah, and the fact that everyone he knows is gone and dead, long gone and dead. And when he gets to other planets, for example, he knows it's not going to be there. Like we mentioned in the beginning, why didn't he just exile him? Why didn't he just throw him into space? Why didn't he just... Because the sword.
Yep.
The sword would still be there. Someone could pick it up. And someone could use it against him. It's the only thing that he knows of that can hurt him. As we've seen right now, the gods didn't come to humanity's rescue at any point. 3,000 years, as far as I can figure, where he's thrown into the future, the gods had nothing to do with it.
Yep.
They were maybe around, but didn't come back to this part of the cosmos. They were busy somewhere else in the firmament, and Aku just took over everything. And when Jack comes back out in the future, that's when the next episode starts immediately.
Yep.
But as a training montage, basically seeing the birth of this hero, seeing how unusual how unusual Jack's beginning was, just as unusual as his father's beginning was.
Yep.
These two are not common heroes. And it's interesting to see uncommon heroes do these things, especially when they have to learn how to deal with things that aren't thrown on other heroes, or that other heroes, because they start from nothing, are used to.
Yeah.
Other heroes are that start from, I was a poor boy in the streets before I received my training. You know, like, I was a beggar that, you know, was a girl disguised as a boy until my sensei found me, and now I am the most powerful female samurai. Whatever narrative is in, you know, their fairy tales or their tales of great heroes, the emperor's kid was raised well. The emperor himself was probably raised well. He had enough training to do emperor things. Yep. And perhaps the good genes that he had from all of this, the way that this happened gave Jack that edge that he needed against something that was far more than just an evil human.
Yeah.
He had to step up the game and accept a little bit more of that celestial excellence into what he does.
Yeah.
But his training allows him to be okay with that. His training gives him the discipline and the mindset that says, this is a responsibility. Mm-hmm. Yes, I have phenomenal cosmic powers, but I have this itty-bitty living space that I must keep myself in so I don't hurt people with what I can do.
Yeah, you're right about that.
And immediately, when Jack gets to the future, he has to start parsing all of this weird stuff again. But we can get into that in the next episode. Yeah. But in this case, do you have any final thoughts about what we've seen here? Or?
Well, no. I feel like we've hit just about everything. Like you were saying, I think this whole thing was showing us what makes Jack the one who can defeat Aku when his dad wasn't. And what makes Jack the one who would get sent to the future where his dad wouldn't.
Yeah, Aku didn't pull that the first time.
Or maybe he would have if Jack's father was foolish enough to let him back out of the sword.
Yeah, he never had the opportunity. That's true. Right. Very, very true.
There was never a chance of that. He just sealed him away in that stump. And maybe if they had known an eclipse would do anything about that, they could have planned ahead. If they know about it now... So if Jack had sealed him, maybe they could try to come up with something, but Jack didn't do that.
Ah, but that knowledge dies with everyone there. That knowledge dies with Jack, basically. Yep. His parents are close to death and will die. His father, definitely. Anyone who was alive when it happened might have noted the eclipse, but would not have connected that to Aku. All of the adults that were adults during that time didn't actually witness the birth of Aku. Very few people got out of that city alive, and everyone else got eaten. So once that knowledge is lost, and people may have a suspicion that that's what happened, there's nothing in any of the world's lore about how to deal with something like Aku.
Yep.
None of the religions that were intrinsic into the cultures that he was exploring and being a part of and training with mention anything about the kind of evil Aku represents.
Yeah. And remember, the Yukio-A, like, painting that depicts the fight with Aku is now burned down.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Aku destroyed the evidence.
Yeah. So...
That was not carved. That was painted.
Yeah. We now know from this episode... more or less why the world became as doomed as it really was, even though two people now have been shown to be able to defeat Aku, at least with the sword. But again, like I said, the main theme here that I'm getting out of this is Jack was repeatedly warned, or the person who would become Jack, that he might not be ready. Don't underestimate the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Deception is evil's greatest tool, you know? Evil always finds a way.
I think that's almost like the theme for Aku for the series.
Yeah.
Like, that's almost something where, you know, with evil finding a way, and Aku flat out deceives people multiple times.
Constantly.
Over the course of the thing. And that's like another mode that he works in, is deceiving people and telling them lies. And why would you ever believe this guy? Of course he's hilarious, but why would you believe him?
But yeah, so I feel that's sort of what we've gotten out of this episode. Cool. And I can't wait to see what we'll be picking up in the next one.
Awesome. So next time, I believe we have episode number 2, which is entitled The Samurai Called Jack, where he gets the name that he goes by for the rest of the series by some street kids that were very enthusiastic about watching him, which I thought was great, because you don't name yourself. You have... other people name you. Like, that's the handle that you get.
Yep.
You know, even sports heroes are like that. They don't name themselves. Like, sports writers do that.
And, I mean, look, maybe, you know, here we are hearkening back to the thing we just saw. Look, maybe he learned about using aliases that people already wanted to name you from Robin Hood.
Good, yeah. Because Robin, you know, Robin Hood was probably not his real name.
Right.
he was known amongst the peasantry as such.
Like.
And it was a brand of
some
sort. You
come out of a portal, you're surrounded by Aku-related stuff, you were sent here by Aku, and somebody asks you what your name is? Your name is Jack. Like Jack. Those other guys were saying.
That
you know?
Sounds fine. It's nice and generic. yeah, it's Jack. That's my name.
Yep.
Totally my name.
So yeah, I think it was a great episode, and I'm looking forward to the next one.
Awesome sauce. So until next time then, this has been Back Jack, the Samurai Jack Rewatch Podcast. I'm Andy.
And I'm Matt.
And we'll see you later, guys.
Bye.
Got some thoughts about the show you gotta get off your chest? Are we completely wrong, or do you love the podcast with a burning passion? Why not let us know? Contacting Andy and Matt is easy. Find us on Facebook. Email us at backjackpodcast@gmail.com. See our notes and reference links over at backjackblog.wordpress.com. Shoot us a tweet at backjackpodcast. And listen directly at, you guessed it, backjack.podomatic.com. That awesome Samurai Jack music remix that you've heard was done by Musicality Music, and you can check out the rest of his stuff at www.musicalitymusic.net. Backjack the Samurai Jack Rewatch Podcast is a Ninja White Star production.